Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Impossible Ward, a heartwarming Regency adventure story by Dorothy Mack, narrated by Sasha Higgins. Chapter 1. The untimely death at the age of 48 of Peregrine Carstairs, 5th Earl of Melford, from injuries sustained in a freak accident on the hunting fields of Leicestershire, achieved the rather unique distinction of surpassing in notoriety a life spent, or misspent, according to one of his more acid-tongued relatives, in committing the sort of follies that give rise to scandalous conjecture amongst the members of that stratum of polite society to which he belonged by right of birth, if not subsequent behaviour. It was not the fact of his putting a violent period to his life that caused raised eyebrows and clacking tongues. For some, such end to his daredevil career had confidently been predicted ever since his naval days, when he had distinguished himself by acts of reckless bravery during the siege of Toulon. At Calvi, where Nelson lost an eye, the second son of the 4th Melford sustained the loss of 2 fingers on his left hand, with no invalid period before returning to duty. In fact, it was not until news reached him during the Battle of the Nile in 1798 of the tragedy of the twin deaths of his father and elder brother in a boating accident, that the new Earl, with extreme reluctance, resigned his commission and returned to his homeland after an absence of over 5 years. Some of his intimates ascribed the vicissitudes of his later years to disappointment at having to renounce his naval career for the duties attaching to a position he had never coveted or thought to occupy. Others, less tolerant, dismissed his actions as being those of a man bent on suicide. Certainly the 5th Earl's subsequent unheedful activities had provided fuel for scandal flames for better than 15 years. Though his name had been coupled on numerous occasions with any number of reigning beauties, both married and single, from the most eligible heiresses to the most outrageous courtesans of Covent Garden fame, not the most enterprising female had succeeded in dragging him to the altar. Therefore, his will, read before a small group of relatives and mourners seated in the sunny library at Maple Grove, the late Earl's principal seat, by a senior member of the firm of Dillingham, Tillingist, Upton and Dillingham solicitors, was destined to create something of a sensation. Mr. Dillingham, senior, coming at last to the end of a long list of bequests to servitors and family retainers, paused momentarily to clear his throat, glancing briefly at the assembled listeners. The predominant expression adorning the faces of his audience was polite boredom, but his next words changed that.
"And all the remainder of my personal property and fortune I bequeath to my daughter, the Lady Marianne Carstairs, to be held in trust until—"
It was extremely unlikely that the trust arrangements under which the Lady Marianne Carstairs would henceforth receive her income penetrated the consciousness of any but one of the astounded gentlemen staring open-mouthed at the prosaic, bespectacled solicitor, before the combined noise of exclamations of shock and disbelief and a subsequent buzz of speculation compelled that cavernous, soberly clad personage to pause yet again in his reading.
"And the sole reason behind my dim comprehension," the one exception was explaining to his maternal parent on the following day, "was undoubtedly that well-known human weakness of vanity that enables one to discern one's own name even in the Tower of Babel."
A self-mocking little smile played around the corners of his well-shaped mouth.
"Your name? What can you mean, Justin? What possible connection can you have with this unacknowledged daughter?"
At the sight of the suddenly squared shoulders and indignant expression turning his soft, charming mamma into a bristling lioness preparing to defend her young, his smile widened to a satisfied grin.
Ah, that had caught her.
Truth to tell, he had been surprised and more than a little disappointed at her unblinking reception of what he had confidently expected to prove earth-shaking news.
No connection at all, so far, he said soothingly. But I strongly doubt my luck shall hold in future, since Perry has been so misguided as to appoint me his daughter's trustee.
What?
Her reception of this piece of information atoned for any earlier want of feeling.
He must have been all about in his head, her ladyship declared flatly, to select an unmarried man of barely 30 years to be guardian to a child, and a female child at that.
In the interests of accuracy, I must correct you, Mamma, on one or two points. My unenviable position is that of a trustee, not a legal guardian, and the female in question is not a child, being, if I recall correctly, some 22 years of age.
22? Gasped the Marchioness. But Perry was not even in the country 22 years ago. At least, I cannot quite recall, but surely that was about the time his ship was sent to the Mediterranean.
A distressing thought crossed her mind and was given immediate utterance.
Justin, do you suppose this girl is the result of an entanglement with a foreigner? I suppose there is proof that a marriage did take place. Or it could all be a hoax. Yes, that would be just like Perry. I vow he would do anything to shock society,
she enunciated in bitter accents, and launched herself into a tirade, recalling some of the Earl's more scandalous escapades, and roundly condemning his thoughtlessness in involving her son in his affairs. Knowing it from long experience as an exercise in futility, the young Marquis did not endeavour to interrupt his parent in full spate, but waited patiently for her to calm down before he attempted to mollify her.
"Now, Mamma," he soothed, "it is not so bad as you fear. There definitely was a marriage, all right and tight and above board."
"To a foreigner?" she demanded straightly.
"No, no, I promise you."
He hesitated briefly, then continued.
"Actually, the girl Perry married was the daughter of an Irish scholar."
He ignored his mother's derisive sniff.
"Her parents objected to the marriage, so he obtained a special license and they made a runaway match of it."
This time the sniff was closer to a ladylike snort.
"They objected to an alliance with one of the oldest families in the land, and a title to boot. You may have been taken in by such a tale, but I assure you I am not such a flat as to swallow whole that faradiddle."
"Mamma, such language from a lady. I am appalled."
But the Marquis's eyes twinkled as he smiled indulgently at his now guiltily blushing parent. One of her most endearing traits, in her son's eyes, was her ability to enter wholeheartedly into their concerns from earliest childhood. They were so in the habit of discussing their affairs with her that over the years she had built up quite a vocabulary of slang and cant terms that occasionally found their way into her conversation at awkward moments, to her intense embarrassment and the everlasting delight of her loving but wickedly appreciative offspring. His eyes grew serious again.
"It is true, nevertheless, Mamma. Old Dillingham gave me a letter Perry had dictated the day he died. The will had been made long since, of course, but he wished to acquaint me with the whole story. To no one, not even Papa, and you know how close they were, had he ever disclosed the existence of a child or the story of his marriage. But he wanted me to know so I would be better prepared to help his daughter. The girl he married was very young, an only child of a late marriage, and her parents doted on her. Perry's father and brother were alive then, so there was no question of a title, and he was always very wild, you know. In any case, her parents forbade the match, and he knew Melford would have cut up stiff if he learned what was in the wind, so he married her out of hand. They had barely a year together. Her parents knew after the elopement, of course, but he did not tell the Carstairs. Hostilities broke out again in 1793, and Perry was ordered to the Mediterranean just about the time the child was due. He planned to take his wife and baby and leave them with his family when he had to report, but before he could prepare them, His wife died giving birth to the child, and he went berserk with grief. He had brought her back to her parents to await the birth, and, Mama, he said he refused to look at the baby who had cost his wife's life. He left it with the stunned grandparents and went to war without telling a soul. He was gone over 5 years, as you must remember, and returned only at the death of Melford and Jack. Did he not go to see the child then? Why hide all these years? Is there something wrong with her? Justin, she is not an imbecile or something of that nature, I trust. He never once set eyes on her, Mama, but he corresponded with the grandparents at infrequent intervals. The girl is perfectly normal. Since her grandmother's death 10 years ago, she has resided with her grandfather on a small property Perry purchased for them in Yorkshire. I gather they live quietly in the country, near Leeds. The poor child. His mother's large blue eyes softened in commiseration. Never to know either parent, hidden away from her rightful inheritance, with only an old man for company, and a scholar at that. She might well not exist for him if he is like some, shut away forever in a musty library, living in a world of books instead of people. What are you going to do, Justin?
Bring her here, if you are willing. Perry wished me to see to her future, find her a husband and establish her in society, as well as handle her income for a time.
Well, I must say that is the outside of enough. He does not ask much. You are to take a country-bred girl, still unmarried at 22, which tells one straight away that she is either an antidote or has never stirred from her grandfather's side, and thrust her into a society for which she cannot possibly be prepared, and he expects you to find a husband to establish her. A Herculean task indeed. It might be different if the girl had a fortune, but most of Perry's property must be entailed, and therefore goes to his nephew, which is indeed a sorry situation for a bigger wastrel than Aubrey Carstairs I have yet to meet. Perry can't have had much of a personal fortune, not with his being a confirmed gamester. Why, if but half the tales of him are true, he was wont to lose as much as £5,000 in a single night in those hells he was forever frequenting.
Now there you are quite out, Mama.
You mean the rumours were not true? Perry did not lose large sums night after night in St. James's Street?
Oh, the tittle-tattle was true enough, but your assumption that Perry had little in the way of a personal fortune is glaringly false. The truth is, he made fantastically successful investments here and in the colonies, and will probably cut up to the tune of around £250,000, all safely invested in the funds.
He flicked open a gold filigree snuff-box with a graceful gesture of his left hand, took a small pinch, and inhaled it easily without taking his appreciative eyes from his mamma's very expressive countenance.
"Close your mouth, love. You resemble a very startled goldfish at the moment. A delectable goldfish, if I may say so, but of rather dim mentality."
His teasing laugh robbed the words of any wounding intent, and, in any case, the Marchioness secretly rather delighted in the affectionate raillery directed at her by her sons, both of whom had tried very hard to make up to her for the loss of her firstborn 3 years before at Salamanca, scarcely surviving his father by a year. Indeed, looking at her, it was difficult to imagine a more pampered little creature, for she was delightfully tiny and delicately made without appearing fragile. As Lady Georgina St. Clair, she had been hailed as the most beautiful debutante of her season when the young Marquis of Lunswick had crossed her horizon and straightaway set out to storm the citadel, to such success that they were married within 2 months of her initial appearance on the London scene. The gold in her hair had faded somewhat, and there were fine lines about her mouth that had not been there before the sudden death of her husband and the subsequent loss of his heir on the field of battle. But she was still a remarkably lovely woman, and when animated, could have denied with no fear of contradiction 10 of her 49 years, if such a thought had ever crossed her mind. Her intensely blue eyes had gradually lost that haunted look that had so concerned her remaining sons, but the elder was thinking now that the animation and vivacity that had been her most appealing characteristic had been in complete abeyance for the last few years. He frowned unseeingly at the small box still in his hand as it flashed across his consciousness that this unknown ward, or more correctly, obligation of his, might just prove a blessing in disguise, if only his mother could be brought to take a real interest in her fate. She had always wished for a daughter. Perhaps she might even be induced to leave Lunswick Hall next year and begin to resume some of her former activities in town during the season, in order to oversee his ward's initial appearance. In the past, his generous-hearted mamma had always been more than happy to devote time to her various nieces during their seasons. In fact, until mourning had driven her into this uncharacteristic apathy, she had been the most gregarious creature alive. If this girl had any possibilities at all, she might provide just the challenge needed to jolt his parent out of her present inertia. His frown deepened as he quelled the nagging thought that Perry's daughter might prove to be utterly impossible. As if reading his thoughts, the Marchioness echoed this one hesitantly. "You know, Justin, she may turn out to be hopelessly ineligible despite the fortune."
"Nonsense, love," he chided bracingly. "No heiress is completely ineligible, be she ever so ill-favoured or underbred. I have the utmost confidence in your ability to make a silk purse out of this particular sow's ear, if so she should turn out to be. In any event, I fancy I can guarantee the lady one eligible suitor at the very least."
His mother raised an inquiring eyebrow.
"Melford," he replied shortly. He was green when it turned out that all Perry's private fortune went to this unexpected daughter, though how in the circumstances he could have anticipated benefiting by one groat more than was necessary under the intel, I cannot imagine. Everyone knew Perry held him in the greatest contempt, and could be expected to divert any assets he could from falling into his nephew's hands. Well, the estate is in fair shape, is it not? Aubrey will not now be driven to seek an advantageous match."
This time her son's answer was slower in coming.
"I have no certain information, of course, but Perry seemed convinced that Aubrey's been living on the expectation for years, seemed to think he's gotten himself deep into the clutches of the moneylenders, in which case he'll need everything he can wring from the estate to settle with them. If past performance is anything to go on, he'll be under the hatches in less than a 12-month. He had no idea how wealthy Perry's daughter is, of course, but I'd not wager a groat on our chances of keeping this news from becoming one of the choicer ondies of the year."
The Marchioness rose from her chair, shook out her pale lavender skirt, and moved over to the fireplace, where her son stared thoughtfully into space. She placed both hands around his arm and nuzzled her head gently against his chest for a moment, before smiling up at him.
"Well, we shall just have to preserve her from Aubrey's designs. I wish he were not quite so handsome with that facile charm that is so deadly to inexperienced girls, but perhaps she will not prove to be at all impressionable. What did you say her name was, Justin?"
"Marianne."
"Pretty," approved his mother. "I hope the girl is attractive, too." She gave a delightful gurgle of laughter. "Do you know, Justin, I am quite looking forward to meeting your ward."
"She is not my ward, Mamma," he reminded her patiently. "I am merely her trustee."
"And marriage broker," she added impishly. "Shall you go north to bring her here yourself?"
"Yes, I feel Perry would expect me to meet the grandfather and assure him the girl will be well cared for."
"I shall write to her, and you will deliver my invitation personally."
"Thank you for your cooperation, Mamma."
This time, there was no element of teasing in the gentle smile the tall man bestowed on her, along with a brief bear hug that rocked her off her feet and brought forth an indignant protest that he had sadly disarranged her cap, not to mention her dignity.
"What dignity?"
inquired her unrepentant son with a grin. Chapter 2. The sun was just beginning to dip beneath the rim of the distant foothills as the Marquis drew rein before a wooden gate a sennight later. He sat almost motionless, except for an absent-minded gentling action on the neck of a huge bay horse, while he narrowly surveyed the property called Crestview Farm that had been home to Perry's daughter for the past 10 years. The lovely stone house, set back no more than 100 feet or so from the lane, never started existence as a farmhouse, he decided. Its charming proportions and ornamented windows proclaimed it a rather tasteful small villa, and he thought it likely that it had replaced an earlier structure perhaps no more than 15 or 20 years before. The pristine condition of the surrounding outbuildings gave mute testimony to the prosperity of the farm. The roofing looked new, the paths were cleared and swept, and there was no lack of fresh paint anywhere. Small, well-kept lawns in front and to the right as far as the bend in the tree-bordered lane made of it a most attractive setting for the jewel of a house. This and the scent of late-blooming roses in a riot of colours, in front of a row of hedges, contributed to a mounting sense of relief, mingling with the more visual pleasure in his surroundings as he opened the gate and leisurely approached the house. The hitherto unacknowledged but pervasive miasma of discomfort that settled on him whenever he considered the deeper implications of his errand lifted a bit as his senses absorbed the green peacefulness of the scene, completely devoid at the moment of another human presence than his own. Useless to deny that he had rather dreaded approaching this young woman, whose acquaintance her own father had never once desired to make. With no company and plenty of time for reflection on the long journey, his wayward fancy had persisted in picturing her as existing at a subsistence level, filled with resentment at the retired life she was compelled to lead through no fault of her own. But surely no brooding melancholy could perpetuate itself in this idyllic setting. Perhaps his mission could be reduced to its simplest terms after all, that of removing the girl to his mother's protection during her period of mourning and her inevitable introduction to society, followed quickly by a provident marriage to someone who might be more than willing to divide his time between Yorkshire and town, or even to retire to this locality permanently. Surely any young woman, no matter how contented with her existence, would experience a sense of excitement and thrill at having her provincial horizons expanded. The girl did not exist who could turn her back on such an opportunity. Inexpressibly cheered by all he saw about him, he hitched the bay to the wrought-iron rail and proceeded to bang the shining knocker. He had written to Perry's father-in-law immediately after the funeral, apprising him of his son-in-law's death and his own planned visit to discuss Lady Marianne's immediate future. The household should certainly be anticipating his arrival, but not knowing their circumstances, he had left his chaise and postillions at the Rose and Crown at the village crossroads and ridden the short distance to Crestview Farm on Mountain, his favourite mount. The Marquis was idly admiring the remains of what must have been a lovely flowering border in summer when he finally heard a heavy, slow tread approaching. He straightened and smiled at the old woman who opened the door and stood regarding him with an unflattering lack of interest.
"Good afternoon. I am Lord Lunswick. I believe Mr. O'Doyle is expecting me."
The woman's flat-featured countenance did not lose one iota of its impassivity at this pronouncement.
"T' master is asleep in his study. Miss Marianne says I mun not disturb him when he drops off like that. Not for nowt."
She declaimed the words as though a formula learned by rote.
"No, of course not,"
Justin agreed hastily.
"In that case, may I see Lady Marianne?"
His smile had been declared an unfair weapon by more than one London miss, but his second effort had no more effect on the implacable servant than the first attempt.
"Miss be down at the barn,"
she declared, shutting the door firmly on the words. For an instant, the Marquis simply stood there staring at the panelled door, natural irritation struggling with a mounting sense of unreality. His first stubborn impulse was to persist in his efforts to gain admittance, but his hand was stayed in midair from rapping more forcefully on the door by an equally strong disinclination to tangle again with an undoubtedly half-witted old crone. Shrugging aside his annoyance, he retreated around the right side of the house toward the cluster of farm buildings. There were no signs of human activity at the large henhouse or in the dairy, but as he approached the barn, he noticed a shadow from a lamp within playing over the doorframe. Entering the dim interior, he stood quietly for a moment, adjusting his eyes after the glare of late afternoon sunshine. He was immediately aware of the contented movements of several animals, but as he moved further inside, he saw no one save a black-clad female farm worker bent over a milking stool, too intent on her task to realize his presence. He passed her and headed slowly down the length of the barn, glancing quickly left and right as he passed two workhorses and more cows. The only lantern was placed to aid the milker near the entrance, which convinced him that Lady Marianne could not be here. He turned to retrace his steps with the intention of interrogating the farm woman, and met the incredulous stare of the latter, who had risen carrying a pail in each hand and was standing there quite motionless, with a look almost of wonder on her face. His disinterested gaze flicked across her person, dismissing her as an object of interest as he continued to approach at an unhurried pace. All expression died out of the girl's face as he diminished the distance between them. She remained silent, and he, who had rarely felt ill at ease in the presence of a female, found himself resenting her silence and constrained to break it. "Can you tell me where I may find Lady Marianne?" Realizing he had spoken rather abruptly, he smiled at her to soften the force of the words, but noted with a mental shrug that this young woman was as immune to any charm of manner he might possess as the old crone who had shut the door in his face earlier. He wondered idly if this might perhaps be her granddaughter. He could not know that to the silent girl standing in the flickering light of the lantern, he had seemed for an instant to be the living embodiment of all the Norse legends, the hero of countless fairy tales. For perhaps 2 seconds while he had turned and come toward her, she had felt irradiated with sheer joy as her eyes dwelt with pleasure on the handsomest man she had ever beheld. Then, as his cool glance had flicked dismissingly over her with contemptuous indifference, she experienced a rare surge of intense dislike that swamped her initial reaction and left her slightly shaken. His curt words did nothing to lessen her dislike, but she answered politely enough. "I'm afraid there is some mistake. My name is Marianne Carstairs, but I know of no Lady Marianne in this vicinity." Initially, the deeper implications of this speech failed to penetrate the dismay induced by the girl's calm recital of her name. He closed his eyes for an agonized second. This dark gypsy of a female, with skin burned brown by sun and weather, carrying 2 milk pails and wearing a none too clean apron over a shapeless black gown, could not be Perry's daughter. It would be utterly impossible to try to foist such a creature into the ton. She was utterly impossible. For a moment he was speechless, as he ruefully recalled his laughing assurance to his mother that no heiress was entirely ineligible. How little he had known. The girl had stiffened at the expression of restrained disgust on his features, and dislike turned to active hatred, completely eradicating even the memory of that first fleeting approval. Swiftly, she set down the milk while she extinguished the lantern. Before she could repossess herself of the pails, however, the stranger had picked them up and was standing politely aside for her to precede him from the barn. For an instant, she seemed about to protest. Then she shrugged and complied silently. The girl glanced warily at him from under her lashes as she passed outside, but he was preoccupied with some thoughts of his own which obviously gave him no pleasure, judging from his frown. After a few steps, however, he stopped and faced her determinedly.
"As I explained to your grandfather, I was a friend of your father's, and it was his dying wish that I come here to see you."
He could not have said quite how he expected her to react to this news, Not with tears, surely, since she had had time to get used to the fact of her father's death, and since she had never even met him, could not be expected to grieve greatly. However, he had not thought to see an expression of shocked amusement cross her face, and he raised questioning brows.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?